Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's waiting.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Monday, September 9th. Welcome back to Self-Discipline Month. My guest today is Scott Hambrick, easily one of my favorite contributors to School Sucks podcast. Scott is also the founder and reader-in-chief at Online Great Books. If you listen to today's show and you go, ha-ha, I like this guy, you can check out more of his work at Online Great Books podcast or the Barbell Logic podcast. I've been on both. And what we set out to do today is to put forth a working definition of self-discipline for this series, what self-discipline is and what it is not. Now, this series will have many voices, but one of the reasons why I wanted to lead off with Scott is because of these two types of work that he does, right? Obviously, he is attracting, more often than not, I would say almost always, highly motivated people to both of these pursuits. Whether we're talking about reading the great works of Western literature or barbell training, these are people who you don't have to like drag them into the thing. They kind of want to be there. But people still come with their own obstacles, with their own self-limiting beliefs. And I figured Scott had probably had to counsel people through such things. Things that can interfere with consistency, progress, stick-to-itiveness. Self-discipline is not just about saying, I'll do it or I won't. It's about, I'll do it and I will continue to do it and I will persevere through the challenges that it brings. And I think in both of those activities, Scott, through his work and through his leadership in these roles, probably ran into a lot of these types of obstacles. So I wanted to get his thoughts on the big picture of self-discipline in this conversation. Now, I knew Scott was going to have interesting things to say about this because before we started recording, we were actually playing around with a few questions. Are some people just wired differently? And if that is the case, can you be rewired? And if that is the case, do you need to be rewired? And these questions relate to some observations we've both made about this emerging self-discipline leadership online industry. People who I think, most of the time through good intentions, are trying to inspire others to action. And we'll also talk about why many of these people are able to build really large and loyal followings on places like Instagram. Their online personas function more for the purpose of inspiration than they do for actual intention and action for the followers. And we're not assigning any blame to the leader or the followers. But one of the points that I wanted to drive home, and again, this is my opinion, so it's certainly, you know, if you've had different experiences, please go ahead and, you know, share stories in the comments or on Facebook about some inspiration into action experience that you had from the stories of one of these people. But I don't really think there is such a thing as self-disciplined leadership. I think the only self-disciplined leadership you'll probably ever have is self-leadership. A concept that we've talked about on this show for years at this point. This is an internal family systems concept, self-leadership is, that starts with, obviously, the knowledge of conflicting parts of our personalities and then the integration of those parts towards some kind of harmony overall and, I think in this case, in specific pursuits. Thus, what self-discipline is self-management based on self-knowledge and consistency. And certainly, it's never going to be do what this other guy does. One thing that we're unable to provide in this series a step-by-step plan for better self-discipline. There are guidelines to follow, but if you're listening to this and this is something that you struggle with, obviously, in the end, the ball is in your court. And we've also learned, and this is one of the things that we're going to explore, that the inventory of actions in our lives that help and that hurt, it doesn't really seem to matter, right? The identification of those items, the helpful, hurtful, really isn't enough to get real and, most importantly, lasting change in our behavior. So the introduction to Scott also provides us a transition here to something that is coming up later this week. Oh boy, wait till you hear about this. On Scott's show, Online Great Books Podcast, he talks about the process of reading the great books, understanding what's in them, and then sharing the wisdom with others as part of the pursuit of living the good life. Now, isolated from philosophy, the term the good life is so abstract that it's almost entirely meaningless. When Scott uses that phrase on the show, it is a reference to a project in philosophy that is thousands of years old. It goes at least as far back as Socrates and one of the philosophers from that era that actually did a deep exploration of the properties of the good life was Aristotle. Now, in certain parts of this work, Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle, who wrote this 2,300 years ago, seems to be describing some of the more challenging features, not like in super specifics, obviously, but some of the challenging features that you know that we encounter in the modern world all the time. Where today it is all too easy to live a simulated or even a counterfeit good life, returning to that very abstract definition of the word good. Now, Aristotle deals with all this, but unfortunately, for too many of us, maybe just some of us, maybe all of us some of the time, many moments of finger quotes good life actually result from attempts to escape situations where our spirits are low or our cortisol is high, fleeing from moments of frustration, boredom, anxiety, loneliness. And I've certainly had many moments where there was a root cause that I needed to address, but I chose to escape into the endless array of available options for escape. I'm old enough to remember a time, by the way, where almost none of these escapes existed, right? Like, if you wanted to get away, you had to be intentional about it. You had to get in your car and go to the liquor store. And then you had to make a second stop at the convenience store to get your pack of cigarettes and your scratch ticket and the most recent issue of Jugs. Yeah, I said Jugs magazine. It's almost like you had a dozen opportunities along the way to catch yourself and realize you were doing something suboptimal. But, oh, here comes the part where he says, oh, today it's so easy. Here is the part where I say, today it's so easy. So many of these escapes are at our fingertips. These crucial decisions happen in split seconds because it's right there. It's these interferences are a click away from what we're working on most of the time. We have this extensive inventory of pleasurable activities that are very, very easy to access. And, oh, here comes the part where he says, well, don't have a victim mentality about it. Here does come that part. Right? That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying take a passive or reactive approach to this in any way. I'm just saying it is very, very important to acknowledge. Now, in a long, drawn-out conversation, this sounds like a completely trite observation. We all know that there is a wide variety of unhealthy, distracting activities for us to jump into that do allow for the simulation of happiness. And we're also aware of the fact that there is a really important distinction. Sounds so obvious to say this out loud or for you to hear this out loud in this monologue, but in those tiny critical moments where the space between stimulus and response can seem so small, if somebody could insert this idea into that split second, for me, it would be very helpful. And the idea is that there is a massive distinction between fleeting pleasures and long-term happiness. And that takes us back to Aristotle, because Aristotle argued that happiness was not a word that you would use to describe a fleeting emotion that could be there one hour and gone in the next. It was this bigger, broader assessment of a life and how it was lived, whether life was happy or not, whether life was good or not. It certainly wasn't an emotion that hinged on some kind of external circumstance. There was no dependence in Aristotle's conception of happiness. And then I guess we can quietly to ourselves ask and answer the question if our happiness has any dependences in it. Yes. Shit, I'm sorry. I think I answered out loud. It's also worth pointing out that Aristotle was responding to a society in ancient Greece, a time where people made a tight association between the good life and the achievement of pleasure. I think Aristotle would say the good life is pleasurable, but don't seek pleasure with the expectation that it brings the good life. In fact, the opposite is often the case. This guy must have been pretty smart. I mean, 2,300 years ago, he understands that people have a habit of seeking pleasure in the wrong ways and in the wrong places, and that this search usually ends up being quite an exhaustive one and actually a distraction from living the good life with its richer definition, where happiness can only be dependent on internal factors. Brett, this sounds so obvious. Well, think of me then. The next time you suddenly find yourself standing second in line at the convenience store holding your issue of Jugs magazine. And I'll think of you the next time I'm there holding mine. And we'll remember this moment. Or whatever, you know, our online equivalent of choice is. It's interesting, right? How in those tiny little frames of time, trading away long-term fulfillment over and over and over again for short-term amusement somehow seems like a pretty good deal. So one of the things that I just heard about a couple of weeks ago from Young Alex, and apparently this is all the rage in self-improvement circles on the internet, is shorthanded as the dopamine fast. Dopamine fast is usually done over a 24-hour period, but there are also, I have discovered, longer and more focused exercises called dopamine detox. And I say focused in that if there was one negative, harmful activity that you find yourself engaging in over and over again, the dopamine detox would be the removal of that thing and then sustaining it over a long period of time, where the dopamine fast is basically just this brief period of depriving yourself of everything that brings you pleasure. And I'm going to do this on Wednesday, and I'll be reporting to you on how it goes. But I blurted this out earlier in the monologue, and I want to reiterate it. This exercise is not about making a culprit out of a neurochemical. It is an exercise in going inward. It is like a day-long meditation. A lot of the things that we're struggling with, a lot of the things that are holding us back, they hardly ever have any kind of simple explanation. And here's one thing that I've observed that I really dislike, and I'm probably guilty of it myself in casual conversation or maybe even in some of the stuff that's been recorded into this podcast. We all understand that there are many complex reasons behind the thoughts and behaviors that have ways of causing problems in our lives. And there does seem to be a bit of a craze right now in blaming dopamine for society's ills, mainly through like pornography and social media. Now, I do want to acknowledge that, yeah, this is an issue and this is a challenge of our time, but it can also be a distraction from this process of going more inward. People on the internet are talking about dopamine the same way they talk about alcohol at AA. That, you know, it has this frame of powerlessness. And as I'm trying to set a tone for what we're going to do here, because this chemistry is obviously going to be a part of it, and I am going to do a whole show about the dopamine fast, I don't want to have the conversation like, oh, they keep putting porn on the internet and all my friends post pictures for me to look at and it spikes my dopamine. I'm not thinking about this as detoxing from something I'm powerless over. I'm thinking about doing this as an experiment in attunement with all of these things that are going on in my head that even though I try to bring some intentional focus to in my life, I still think there's way too many things that are passing me by. So what happens in a 24-hour period if all of those distractions are removed? Understanding my brain chemistry, not blaming it, not saying there is a dopamine exploitation industry wreaking havoc on our entire society. It's not the approach we're taking. I told you guys I had been building a folder in Evernote for a couple of years on the topic of self-discipline. And one of the things that was in that folder was this blog from maybe like almost 3 years ago. I found it on Psychology Today. It was by David Lay. It was called No, Dopamine is Not Addictive. I'm probably going to read this whole article into the next show, but I just wanted to share this part of it with you. People's problems are never simple. And when a person does a thing over and over, even when the behavior is causing problems, there are a great many complex reasons behind that behavior. when we offer the reductively simple answer of because dopamine, it distracts us from the person. He's speaking as a psychotherapist. It is the person who learns, and dopamine is merely a factor, one factor among many in the learning. When we encourage people who are watching too much porn, using their cell phone while driving, or looking at Facebook every 2 minutes to blame their problems on dopamine, we teach them to externalize the problem. Instead, if we focus on the learning and the salience aspects of this process, it helps us to draw people's attention back to their own behaviors, their own motivations, and the meaning that they have given to the behavior or experience. It helps us put people back in the driver's seat of their lives. So please, let's start talking about people rather than irrelevant neurochemicals. Irrelevant is a strong word, but I take his point. So again, the dopamine fast is merely a shorthand for what I think can be a potentially very enriching exercise, and I will obviously report to all of you folks on how it goes. Feel free to join us. It's happening this Wednesday, September 11th. But for now, we'll move on to my conversation with Scott Hambrick. And speaking of events, Scott is one of the day one presenters at the upcoming University Virtual Summit, Ideas into Action. Day one of the summit focuses on best practices in information acquisition. Scott's presentation will be on Mortimer Adler's How to Read a Book or Anything Else Most Effectively. And we had at least as much fun in that conversation as we had in the one that you are about to hear. If you want to learn more about Scott, you can go to onlinegreatbooks.com. There's links to the podcast there. I recommend you listen to it. I am the editor of it. I am a fantastic podcast editor when properly compensated. And if you are, let's say, inspired by the story that Scott told on his last appearance, Filling the Trough, I'd also recommend you check out the work he does at Barbell Logic. That is barbell-logic.com, and check out the very fun podcast he does with Matt Reynolds. And if you want to learn more about the summit, all the presenters, what they're presenting on, and what's happening day to day, please go to SSPUniversity.com/summit for today and tomorrow only, for School Sucks listeners only. You can access two special offers, two different ways of absorbing and participating in what will probably be, over the course of 3 days, close to 20 hours of information and interaction. And I said I was only going to say this once. I guess that turned out not to be true, because now the clock is ticking. And like I said before, I want to get as many School Sucks people in the door as possible. So I will say it on the podcast just this once more, since we're inside the final 48 hours on this offer. When you go to sspuniversity.com/summit, at the very bottom of the page, after you read about what the problem is that the event sets out to address, how the summit will address it, and the goddamn magic that each presenter will bring to the summit, you'll see some registration options. Select the $1 for 1 day option. On the following page, you put in your information. We are going to offer you an all-access pass at a reduced price. If you say no to that offer, a new page will load, and you can attend the summit, see all the presentations, participate in the Q&As and the live streams and the ongoing discussions for just $49. This is the best deal that is ever going to exist. Part of me hates that this deal exists. Such a deal. But I want you there, and this is the most affordable way to get there. You can also watch a promo video while you're there. And on my Instagram, and you should follow me on Instagram. I mean, your life will just be better if you do. I'm posting even shorter preview snips from some of the presentations. I just put one up with Michael Malice today. So go and check it out. At the end of the show today, Scott and I will talk a little bit more about this, and we'll also talk about online grade books, their enrollment. They only open their enrollment once in a while. That's a pretty exclusive thing, but it opened yesterday and it stays open for a week, so Scott will provide details at the end of the conversation. If that's an exercise in self-discipline that you think you might want to participate in, stay tuned until the end of the show. Or if that is interesting and I could pick how I would like you to do that, you would go to onlinegreatbooks.com/schoolsucks to enroll for that. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I certainly did. And we'll be back very soon with more installments of this series. We love fun. We're going out and having some. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
We left off in the middle of what I told the listeners was going to be a brief series, at least a two-parter, on learning. You had concluded that episode with one of the most heroic stories I had ever heard. The name of the episode was Filling the Trough.
Ah, right, right.
And we did agree that, like, we should try to get you here once a month. I love the conversations that we have. But something happened a couple weeks ago that made me want to divert my content for the month of September, possibly into October. And it was around the topic of self-discipline. Have you heard about this?
I've heard about self-discipline. I'm skeptical.
You're skeptical. I like that. I'd like to see where this is going to go. We do a bonus show for the people who support School Sucks. It's called The Discomfort Zone. And a couple weeks ago...
That's where I fill the trough, by the way.
Yes, yes, in the discomfort zone. Yes. Very, very important concept and an important place that I'm trying to live with serenity in more and more of the time in my life at this point, in various aspects of my life. I think there's places where I've always felt at home in a discomfort zone, and then there's some places where the discomfort zone kind of terrifies me, you know? So... A couple weeks ago, Andrew, who co-hosts the show with me, we are talking to young Alex, a longtime listener of School Sucks. He's 26 years old, having some struggles with the idea of purpose and finding a purpose. And Andrew and I, Andrew's 33, I'm 42, we're amazed that a 26-year-old man is even contemplating such questions. And we have a pretty interesting discussion about that. And about two-thirds of the way through, an argument begins about this idea that Andrew puts forth, that I disagree with vehemently, of hating yourself into action. And that will be like the part one, the introduction to this series, because even though there was a lot on which my co-host and I disagreed in our advice to young Alex, I'm thinking that he was getting at a kind of truth in a problem and a conversation that a lot of us have had with ourselves. I think in the show, I admit it's a conversation that I've had with myself. That being said, as we look at like different schools of thought in self-discipline, harsher versus softer, more self-forgiving kinds of approaches, as you look out at the theater of self-discipline and self-discipline advice, what are your initial thoughts or reactions to the conversation that's going on out there?
Oh, God, you're just baiting me. You're just baiting me, Brett Vinat. There is this whole... I've got hiccups, by the way.
We're going to get through it.
I'm going to use my self-discipline to stop all my autonomic reflexes in my body. No, there's this school of thought like typified by one Jocko Willink, I think, about this, you know, rise and grind and rub some dirt on it and do it anyway. And I think that Jocko is just like that. I mean, he thinks he has discipline.
Mm-hmm.
He's just twisted that way. You know, he's doing exactly what he wants to do and then acts like it's self-discipline. Then he acts like he doesn't want to get up at 4:30 and do it. You know what I mean? Like, if Jocko didn't want to get up at 4:30 and rise and grind and push through his day and be a Navy SEAL, he wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
He didn't do that through some sort of heroic act of will. He is that kind of person already. And then he gets up in front of everybody on social media and acts like it. Well, maybe it is virtuous. But he acts like he has some sort of control over it. And I would argue that he doesn't. I would argue that he is a red-blooded, hard-charging, alpha kind of guy who likes to challenge himself every day, who finds that gratifying and feels more alive when he's that way.
Right.
Hambrick, however, sure does like to sleep till about 7:15 a.m., which ain't too bad.
No.
And I don't like running.
Yeah.
And I don't like jumping out of airplanes. And there's no amount of self-discipline that would ever make me the kind of person that did that for a living or did that kind of thing day in and day out. I will, however, go squat in the 400s and poop my pants.
Yeah.
But that's not because I've got a lot of self-discipline. It's just because I'm crazy.
But other people would look at that and say, man, that must take... Because, all right, so this is my framing of the show and bringing you on. I say, here's Scott Hambrick, somebody who, the more we talk... the more you impress me. Now, this might all be a trick. This might all be a trick.
I'm lulling you into complacency, and then I spring.
So, you know, we started talking and you presented yourself as like a fan of School Sucks. So that sure. creates a certain kind of dynamic. And then I start digging into your work and I'm like, holy shit, look at this guy doing this. You know, first of all, you do the Barbell Logic podcast, and that is sort of a signal that you send to alert people to the strength coaching that you do. Is that a fair description? That it's sort of like an outward projection of, you know, you guys talking about your work.
And we like talking about that stuff, so we hit record.
Absolutely. The other thing you do is online great books, basically a reading club that uses accountability, which is, I would certainly say, an element of self-discipline, bringing a group of people together to read the great works of Western literature. And I'm thinking, all right, here's a guy sort of at the intersection in his work of two of the things where people struggle the most with self-discipline, right? Number one is exercise and health. And number two is reading. I mean, it is an incredibly difficult. I hate to admit it, but it is just so much harder to sit down and read a book today than it was 10 or 15 years ago. I felt like in 2006, 2007, I was reading all the time. And now I feel like I'm never reading. And so I look at what you put out there and I say, man, what is his secret when it comes to self-discipline? And we're going to learn that none of this is secret, but that was my initial question, because you appear to have a lot of it.
Well, let's talk about barbells and books.
Sure. Yeah.
My partner, Matt Reynolds, in the Barbell Logic podcast, and I argue about this all the time, and it's mostly off air, where he wants everybody in the world to deadlift. And I do too. I actually think that the world would be a better place if everybody deadlifted double body weight. There's something about it that changes people.
Yeah.
You realize, well, it just firmly roots you in reality in a way that not everything can. And he, you know, he wants the world to deadlift, and I do too, but I know that they won't, because it's hard.
Yeah.
And people don't want to do that stuff. And I want everybody to read Plato, but I know they're not, because it's hard and not everybody's going to do that stuff. I think that we, both at Barbell Logic and at Online Great Books, have found a way to put ourselves in front of people that already kind of want to do it.
Yeah.
And make it easier, maybe, for people who already wanted to do that. I have never convinced somebody who didn't want to deadlift to pull double body weight.
Yeah.
Now, there's no way you can do that. I'm not a very talented lifter. And my wife Charity and I talk about this all the time, that there are two kinds of people that barbell train. One does it as medicine, and then that's me. Like, I want to keep my bone density up. I want to be strong. I want to be able to eat the foods I want to eat. I want to manage, you know, I want to not have aches and pains as I age. I'm 44. I'm decently strong. I'm stronger than most people. But in the world of that we're in, I'm not. Like, I've got about a 430 squat, a 500 deadlift, a 220 press. Now, my wife is different. She doesn't do this for medicine. She is a savage. She deadlifted 330 for a set of five the other day. Mm-hmm. She's pressing 160. She's squatting in the mid 300s. And for a 44-year-old lady, those numbers are ridiculous. But she's driven to do it. So I'm having to pull on my self-discipline maybe a little more than her. Like, she's got something to prove. She has an internal motivation to do this that I don't have. You can't reach those kind of numbers if you're just casual. You know, you can't do that if it's just white knuckle discipline day in and day out. It takes years to accrue that kind of strength. She has an internal motivation to do that I don't have, because I don't want to.
Right, right, right.
And there's no amount of kicking my own butt and my own bootstraps that's going to go make me do that hard, hard training for years and years and years on end to accrue that kind of strength.
So if we combine what you're saying now with kind of your assessment of Jocko Willink,
he wants to do it, man.
You think either have it or you don't.
Well, I think that there are areas in life that we all have motivation to do different things in our lives. I probably do things that Willing wouldn't do. And I've already said that there are things he does that I won't do. I hope the optimistic part of me hopes that there is something that any given person is motivated to do that would give them some sort of an edge in that area. I deal with all the budget stuff here at the house. Mm-hmm. You know, and I manage the investments and stuff. Charity's not going to do that.
Right.
Not going to do it. I enjoy it. You know, I get my spreadsheets out and get my Hewlett-Packard 12C calculator out and do all that stuff and enjoy it. It's not an effort for me. I do it three or four times a week. I mean, I deal with this stuff all the time. She's not going to do it. There's no amount of discipline in the world that would get her to do that. She'll set on attack before she would do that, you know. But she'll go pull 6x5 deadlifts three times a week in preparation for nationals on November 16th in Portland.
Okay. Yeah. So I think what we're saying starts to move us towards definition, and I'm going to finish with what you just said. But I think obviously self-discipline is sort of a nebulous concept, right? It just means like people think about it and it's like bite the bullet, eat the frog, suffer, those kinds of things. And like if you bring in what Willink is all about, then there's some kind of virtue in doing that thing. I think self-discipline is not a personality trait that you either have or you don't have. And, you know, the two biggest shortcomings in myself that I've identified have been financial self-discipline and entrepreneurial self-discipline. And obviously the two are very closely related. And they certainly bleed into other areas of my life in a negative way, where I think my self-discipline is actually pretty good, right? They have a way of sapping and sabotaging other things. So I remember talking in a mastermind group a while back, and somebody who had achieved quite a bit of success entrepreneurially said, some people just might not be able to do this. And I remember I wasn't a fully conscious experience, but I definitely remember there being like a sigh of relief when this person who's very successful in you know, online pursuits said, maybe you just don't, not to me, but generally speaking, maybe you just don't have what it takes. Maybe this is just a tiny percentage of people. And I said, oh, that's a relief. Then I think part of the relief comes in, all right, then self-discipline is also not forcing myself to overcome some kind of resistance by using willpower. You know, I have a very limited amount of willpower anyway. But there's still things on the other side of these discomforts, of these self-imposed obstacles that I want, that I have to get, that I'm getting slowly, but not in a way, not at a pace which is satisfying to me currently in life, right? So I'm trying to think about self-discipline as a skill that can be learned. And like with so many things that we've talked about on School Sucks through the years, has to do with a kind of self-knowledge and self-awareness about subconscious resistors, right? Subconscious resistance to action, and then creating a plan of action once those things are identified to overcome them. I don't know if you heard the shows that we did about like internal family systems therapy and the concepts of self-leadership. But this just keeps coming up again and again in every single thing we do. And it's useful here in thinking about self-discipline as a learned ability to basically direct and regulate all of these various and often competing parts of our personalities, you know? I mean, we're all these, we're desires, we're emotions, we're needs, we're fears, which I think fear is the biggest like thing in the way of the skill or the ability of self-discipline. We have our thoughts, we have our morals, we have our intellect, we have our painful memories, we have our imagination. And if you think about imagination of what could be and what you want, and I mean, I think about like, what if I could just reach a million more people with what I do? And then I think about the memories of all these embarrassing and stupid actions and failures, and those two just collide, you know? And it's so to try and bring all that forward and then really sort it out and be able to regulate that and have everything harmonized. I really think this is possible, even though I haven't done it yet in many areas of my life, to harmonize and then move forward towards what I know is on the other side of all this shit that I'm putting in my own way.
That's a whole lot, Brevinot.
Take whatever part of it you want to respond to.
I don't think you're wrong. Mm-hmm. We clearly have some ability to self-direct and to exert self-discipline. We all manage to take in enough food to not die. You know, my hygiene's pretty okay. Like I managed to use soap and water enough that people will be around me. I mean, you know, there are definitely things that are within our scope of agency that we can exert the sort of discipline over and put some structure around and plow through day in and day out. Mm-hmm. You know, it's important for me to realize what those kinds of things are and not try to put the kinds of things that I don't have any hope of pursuing 4 months on end, you know, and to make sure I don't put those sort of things in my self-discipline bucket. Like, I'm not going to try to compete at the United States Strength Lifting Federation Nationals. I'm not going to try to qualify. I don't want to do it. I'm not going to grind myself to powder 4 days a week, 5 days a week training to get a qualifying total to go to Nationals. I just don't want to do it. It's too much. And so I have to be kind to myself, even though a lot of the people that I'm around, a lot of the people that I work with, my wife, have those kinds of aspirations. And they aren't just aspirations. They actually do these things. So it's important for me to be okay with not being that kind of guy and to be all right with squatting 440
mm-hmm.
instead of 605, which a lot of guys my age and my stature can do.
Yeah.
But that's okay. 440 is enough.
Okay. So when you say enough, let's dig a little bit more into your story, right? You are successful as a strength coach. You have built a successful online platform in Online Great Books. You were a successful businessman before that, right? You yep. have a happy family. You have two children. You have all these things going for you, right? And maybe like that's just superfluous is competing. It's not like, oh, you know, I'm really struggling with this idea that I can't, compete on a national level in doing these kinds of lifts. You don't need it, right? Nope. Like, I mean, that would be just my outside take on what you've been telling me. But I think there's a lot of people, and this is kind of me channeling young Alex's 26-year-old aspiring. Well, he's not aspiring. He's succeeding, certainly to a certain extent, in marketing and copywriting. Trying to figure out like what is going to give my life meaning, what is going to give my life purpose. I think that there's an Alex being representative and me being representative of a lot of people in the audience who are still maybe asking ourselves this question of like, how are we going to make it? I had ways of making it that I walked away from. I'm convinced that I have a way of making it, and making it is very vague. I guess there's people who would look at me and say that I've made it in a certain extent, but not to my definition of making it. And I think young Alex feels the same way about, you know, his definition of making it or identifying a purpose and then achieving that purpose.
But there's no it.
You okay.
There's no it. Like, I sold data storage, my business of 21 years, in December of 2018. And we can live off our dividends.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wholly and entirely unsatisfying. What am I going to do with myself? You know, I don't set the alarm. Don't even have a clock in the bedroom, by the way.
Yeah.
And I get up when I get up. And what am I going to do with myself?
It seems like you've got more than enough things.
Yeah, but who cares? Like, really? You know, I get up here and I record 4 podcast episodes a week, plus some guest appearances with you. People would be like, wow, how do you do four original hours of content a week? I don't know. How do you not do it? Like, I have nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't have anything to do with it. I talk my ass off all the time. I just talk.
Right.
I talked this much to people before, but we just didn't have any microphones. You know, we just figured out a way to turn the microphones on and then have somebody, you know, edit them so that they were lovely enough. And we sent them out. I think I have free will, you know?
Yeah.
But just within a certain scope of things. Like, there's certain things that I can make decisions about, and everything else just kind of happens. I have to kind of get out of its way.
Well, there must be some kind of self-knowledge component to this, right? You're doing the things that you want to do. You're doing things that bring you joy. But in all of these things, and I think you're you know, running a business for 21 years is probably applicable to this too. There's probably a lot of things that you don't want to do, right?
Oh, for sure. When I sold that business.
Right.
Yeah.
But you persevered through that for 21 years.
Right.
So what's the story there?
Well, I was definitely motivated by fear. I'm unemployable.
Oh, amen. Like, yeah.
I mean, it's just a fact. I'm unemployable. I have problems with authority, can be a dick, have weird skill sets that are hard to present in job interviews and find matches for in the open market. And I think that, not, no, I don't think this. I know that a great deal of the success there, if not 80% of it, was strictly motivated by fear and the knowledge that if I couldn't do it that way, it wasn't going to happen at all.
Right.
Get a job, fight to keep it. Not an option for Hambrick.
Right.
Not an option. So
fear
was a big motivator there. And that's not a good way to be, not a good way to live.
But fear is also like for, and that was like the other thing that I wanted to talk to you about, because I was thinking about, you know, the end of our last conversation and just knowing the feeling of like getting ready to squat, like in my own life, right? And unracking something that is questionable and beginning to descend is kind of a, you know, you said in the last show, that's where you see Buddha, you know, that's a kind of a special challenging place to go to. So there is fear that is useful, and it sounds like you use it there and you used it to be successful in business. But I think fear is also the root of obstacles in, you know, the ability of self-discipline.
Yeah, I reckon it could be crippling, but it could also get you to get the crops in on time.
Mm-hmm.
We got to get these crops in because winter's coming and we got to put it all this up or we're going to starve to death and we're going to have to eat one of the children, you know? So, you know, fear can be motivating, but I'm not going to jump out of an airplane.
Right.
Just because I can find a way to squat heavy doesn't mean that I can find a way to do any other goddamn thing. You know, that's the thing that bothers me about this. Like there's this like modern American notion that we can just manage anybody into anything. You know, and I just don't think it's true. Like I can't be Jocko Willink and I don't want to be, and I can't go to medical school and grind it out for 8 years of school or however long it takes to do be a doctor. I mean, I can't have the discipline to do any given thing, but I can keep my ear to the ground and kind of figure out the things that I can have the discipline to do on a regular basis and leave the woodpile a little taller week in and week out and then do those and then be kind to myself, even though I don't want to jump out of planes. I'm scared to death to scuba dive.
Mm-hmm.
Claustrophobia, just even thinking about it. There's no self-discipline that's going to make me do that.
Has this been proposed to you? Have you been pressured to scuba dive?
I've got a friend that loves it, and I love him. And he's like, man, you need to go get certified. He's got a house in the Philippines. He's like, we'll go to the Philippines. We'll scuba dive for like 6 weeks. I'm like, I hope you enjoy that, because I'm going to sit right here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, above the water.
Right, right.
I was like, oh, there are these wrecks, and we can go in these sunken ships. I'm like, fuck that.
Yeah.
Nope.
Oh, could you imagine not only being that far underwater, but also being inside a ship?
That's right.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, you can go through this, went in this door. And no.
Yeah, that might not be for me either. What's the hang up with skydiving? I'm actually starting to debate it. I'm getting real into the idea of state changes. I just did the Joe Rogan style sensory deprivation tank maybe like a month ago. And I found that to be, I was in there for an hour, Scott, an hour. Mm-hmm. With no sensory input to speak of.
Right.
And it was so, man, it's like, I'm kind of a nervous guy, you know, always sort of feeling what's going on in my body. And I can get inside my head. And, you know, I go into this thing and I'm like, boy, I hope I don't die. I hope I don't die. I hope I just don't in an hour go completely crazy in here. And, you know, have some kind of a medical event. So
did you get out of there and just write a bunch of stuff?
I went in there feeling extremely negative. There's some stuff going on in my family that was really bothering me with one of my siblings. This was like the height of my tension around this, because I was about to go back to New Hampshire. I was 5 days away from going to having to face this situation in New Hampshire. And I go in there, and at first it's like, okay, you can't see anything, you can't hear anything, you have earplugs in, right? And your ears are kind of submerged below the water level. So all you hear is like this mechanical distant hum of whatever's like regulating the temperature and filtering the water. And so that's very much like white noise. So
did you pee in there? Don't lie to me.
Okay, we're getting to that. We're getting to that. Okay. So then, like, what's the next most present sense feeling? Okay. The water is the same temperature of the surface of your skin, which is about 95 degrees, maybe. So as you sit there, it feels like you're just dissolving into the water, that you're just becoming nothing. There is no smell. So you're pretty much almost entirely deprived of all five of your senses. So for me, in my, you know, mental hypervigilance, my attention turns inward. And I start to become extremely aware of everything that's happening in my own body. Now, I'm in the float tank with another person who purchased this as a birthday gift for me. It is my birthday.
Thanks a ton.
No. Like I really appreciated and accepted the challenge of doing this. And it was important to her. So we're in something that's like a little bigger than a large hot tub, right? So we're not like floating around and bumping into each other, but we're in there together. And like, if we want, we could pop up our heads and just talk to each other. But that's it's I start becoming very aware of what's going on inside my own body, specifically in my digestive system, right? Mm-hmm. I start to feel air moving through. It's called borborygmus. I start to feel that air moving through my body. And it's like, oh, my God, what if I have to go to the bathroom? And so then this physical sensation turns into a mental panic. And it's like, well, I can't feel the things that control me not going to the bathroom right now. So who knows? Maybe it already happened, right? You know? And that became kind of an ordeal that lasted probably about 15 minutes. And then...
That's a long time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I actually was surprised how fast the time went by. I thought robbed of all your senses or deprived of all your senses, it would seem like you were in... An hour would seem like 3 or 4 hours, you know, when it's just you to count the seconds, if that's how you choose to use the time. Then about 15 minutes into it, I just surrender. You know, I say, this, whatever you're doing with your mind is not the best use of your time in here. Just go into your mind, find the things that are bothering you, explore them uninterrupted, face them. It's like me making a Jocko Willing Instagram post in my head.
Right.
You know? And just see what they're all about and experience them and do it with... you know, some kind of footing of serenity. And if it's about resentment or anger towards other people or lack of forgiveness with yourself, do it with forgiveness. And man,
let that anger wash over you and through you. Embrace your resentments.
Well, let them feel them, you know, because there's nothing else to do in there. And then at the end of it, it was like this incredible renewal. And I walked out of there totally serene, incredibly happy, incredibly relaxed, and it lasted, you know, weeks. It made this New Hampshire trip that I was so tense about just, you know, easy. Despite, you know, some unpleasant things that I encountered when I got there, it was manageable, and I really see that state change as part of the experience. So,
are you going to do DMT now, bro?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that's only 15 minutes.
Right.
You know,
I had a similar experience actually just the other day.
Yeah.
I had this really saggy eyelid that was, I couldn't hike it up enough to get my eyelashes out of my visual field. So I'm reading through my eyelashes all the time. You know? Mm-hmm. So I had my eyelids repaired. I went to the ophthalmologist. She's like, yeah, I can't even see your eyes when you'd have them repaired. So I had that done. And, that was Tuesday. Today is Thursday. Tuesday night, I didn't sleep at all. And I just laid there kind of elevated because they told me to be elevated at 30 degrees with a ice pack on my eyes. So I can't see anything. Everybody's asleep. So I was just there. It was just me. I listened to a podcast a little bit, but I got tired of that even. And it was just me for, I don't know, 6 hours. Like every now and then the cat walks by.
Mm-hmm.
I had so many ideas. I got up and then dictated a whole bunch of, like blog post stuff and just felt clean.
Anything uncomfortable?
I hate the world. I mean, that part, is that what you mean? like disgust with the direction of so many things, but no, as far as like my, you know, my personal stuff, my self-worth work, no, nothing there right now.
And this whole tangent came from my question about skydiving. You're getting pressure to skydive because that's definitely a state change.
Yeah, I'm just not a physically courageous person. I don't want to, at this point in my life, I see no reason to stand in the doorway and make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Not interested.
Well, you can do tandem, you know, where you jump with a guy strapped to your back and then he's in charge.
That seems worse. Like you being on my back is not going to make it better.
Oh, yeah, true. So now why are we talking?
Now, but squatting can be very scary.
Okay, this is back to the fear thing. Yeah, yeah.
But I know something about it. and I can program my work and build up to a culmination of a, you know, a strength performance, a PR event, personal record event. I can know that next week I'm going to squat 445, let's say. By the way, I can't squat right now because I just had this little surgery. And so I'm so fucking happy that I don't have to train for the next 4 weeks. But if I know that a PR event's coming and I'm going to squat 445, well, maybe the next week I finish every single, maybe I finish every session by just walking out 475, maybe even 500.
And
like
not,
I don't squat, yeah. I just walk it out and I just stand there for a 20 count and then rack it and just start to acclimate myself to the thing. I can wade into the deep end of a squat, you see. Like mm-hmm. I know what's going on. I know I've done my work. I know that the programming's been good. I know that my equipment's right. I know what to do, and I can do it. And I know that people can do that with scuba diving as well. But it just so happens that I understand squatting and that I can do that. And so I do.
So we talked about this, though, in an earlier show. Might have been the first show on learning, because you were talking about you're training a couple of young guys, right? And there was some kind of issue that was like representative of the generation that we talked about. I can't remember exactly what it was, but you were kind of lamenting about it was the kids these days kind of thing that we do, that we are doing now. We talked about the perseverance, the facing the fear, and the facing the discomfort as kind of a portable experience that we can take to other pursuits in life. And that's one of the reasons why for years, and when I've given advice to like people that I care about, if they were in a bad way or having a bad time or feeling depressed, like moving the body and doing challenging things with your body is the place to start. So what say you about the portability of that experience to other pursuits?
I think you can sublimate your lessons from the squat rack into other parts of your life.
Yeah.
But there are people who don't want to pull heavy or squat heavy.
Yeah.
They're just not inclined that way. And they need to find something else. Maybe they need to box. Maybe they need to train for a marathon. I don't know why anybody would do that.
Yeah, sure. I think what we're saying about squatting is very universalizable to other things.
Yes. Yeah, we can have areas of life that where we can apply ourselves and we can, you know, face the tiger or whatever, and then learn how to do it, to gain confidence in ourselves in doing so, and then take it to those things that are on the fringes of our experience and do it. Like if I had to, I could jump out of that airplane.
Yeah.
But I don't have to.
If there was a tiger in there.
If there was a tiger in there.
Because we don't want to face tigers. I mean, come on.
If I had to jump out of the airplane.
Yeah.
I could. But I don't have to. I don't have to get up at 4:30 like Jocko. I don't have to do the thing the other person does. And if I don't, that doesn't mean I don't have any discipline. It doesn't mean I'm a failure.
Yeah.
Can I tell you a filthy joke that you're going to cut?
Yep.
My dad told me this joke one time, and you'll cut it. Or actually, don't. I don't care what you do. World War II vet, the grandson came to the World War II vet and said, "Grandpa, what did you do during the war?" And he said, "Well, son, I was a paratrooper." "Really? Well, what was that like?" He said, "Well, I went to ground school, and they taught us how to pack the parachute and rig our parachutes, and then we would jump off of this tower and, you know, successively higher towers, and then eventually it's time to jump out of the plane. The green light comes on and you hook up your static line, you go to the door, and then you're supposed to jump." He said, "And I froze. In that moment, I froze. I was supposed to jump." And the sergeant ran over to me and yelled, "If you don't jump out of this airplane, I'm going to fuck you up the ass." And the kid said, "Well, Grandpa, did you jump?" And he said, "Well, a little bit at first." So my dad told me that when I was like 12.
Oh, we'll keep it. What a story, right? You know, with tandem skydiving, just really, really quickly, you can do...
Well, did you jump?
You can jump and you can do Grandpa's story at the same time if you want. All right. So my goal for the show today, and I want to make sure we deliver for the audience on this, was to have a basically just a definition of self-discipline. And that was why, and I already talked to you about the kind of contributions that I wanted from you, and I definitely appreciate them. So I want to get your thoughts on a couple more things. I want to do a little bit more on just, you know, driving home this idea that there is a skill, like that relief that I felt in that moment where it's like, yeah, maybe this just isn't you. And I said, whew, I don't want people to give up like that. And I think that that was the point in this episode that people will have already heard at this point, this argument that I had with Andrew and Alex, that they were making that I now agree with. Like, there is something that is important about being kind to yourself and forgiving of yourself, but not to relegate yourself to less than what you can be and not to resign. And I think that people, because we start with kind of a nebulous concept in self-discipline, people make the mistake of seeing symptoms of difficulty with self-discipline as causes, right? You hear people say, and you've probably heard some of these things in both the types of coaching and mentorship that you've done, right? I don't have good self-discipline because I'm lazy. I don't have good self-discipline because I procrastinate. I don't have good self-discipline because I lack ambition, or I don't have good goals, or I'm indecisive, or I can't, you know, and this was even an approach we took on the show in the past towards self-discipline. It's really, it starts with like organization, time management, and basic productivity skills. But I would say that all of those things are symptoms and not the cause of a lack of self-discipline.
Yeah. You saying that made me think of something. People will say that about, you know, having discipline in the gym. And the reason I weight train heavy is because I'm exquisitely lazy.
Hmm.
Pound for pound, minute for minute of work put in, it gets me the most. I'm not going to run. You know, I'm not going to do P90X. Like, I do it because it's because I'm lazy. It's easier for me than the other thing.
Yeah.
And I've been able to recognize that. You know, so even what seems like self-discipline is really me doing what's easier for me.
I think it's an example, though, of the harmony that I was talking about, right? Like in some kind of recognition of, it was another thing that I said in this previous show, this discomfort zone that turned into an argument, was like, you have to be honest with yourself. If I had to define fitness by running, I would just fail, you know? Right. And I did like basic like split routine weight training for a long time and, you know, got good results and was in good enough shape, and then turned 30 and things that had worked didn't work anymore. And I had to start to find new ways to challenge myself. We talked before, and we can geek out on this for a couple minutes. I'm sure most people won't mind. The dog crap discovery in 2013 is a totally different way to train. And it was about learning my limitations, learning what I didn't want to do. But then I've also found, and like that was, to speak to what you said about efficiency, like, you know, getting the most out of the minimal amount of work, that's kind of become my new fitness philosophy. Is like, if I can be in and out of there in 45 minutes and training efficiency, like minimal sets, lots of weight, but minimal sets, minimal time invested, you will sweat. But I love that workout. And occasionally, once in a while, when I need a break from it, I'll do something insane. You know, not like CrossFit insane. I'm not trying to seriously hurt myself.
Yeah, we like ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's not
we're
about
good people here.
Right, right. So I'll do
that's why I barbell train. 3 sets of 5 squats, 3 sets of 5 presses, a set of 5 deadlifts. I'm out.
Yeah. And occasionally I'll just throw in something like cluster sets where you do 10 consecutive sets with the same weight with 5 seconds of break in between. So you start with 10 reps for set one and you should be at 1 rep for set 10. And you are drenched in sweat after doing one of these. So like that's a nice thing to switch it up once in a while. And it's definitely out of my comfort zone.
How do you have the discipline to do that though, Brett?
I that's what my point is. I think it starts with like an honest assessment of self. Right.
What can you bear to do? What can you bear to do? And just leave the wood pile a little taller every time. You know, be aware of what those things are, find them and cling to them. Because if we find something that we can iterate into and just do a little better every time, you do that for, I don't know, 3 or 4 decades and you might have something, you know?
Yeah.
The data storage business that I had and even Online Great Books to some degree, it has this residual income thing in it, you know?
Yeah.
So particularly at data storage, if I didn't want to do anything for a week, there was stuff I had to go in and do. I had to pay the electricity bill. There was a minimum amount of stuff I had to do. But I didn't have to go pound the pavement and get new accounts every single week.
Right.
Like even within that business where I showed up 5 or 6 days a week for 20 years, it was tailored to suit what I could do.
Yeah.
On one hand, I was fortunate. that that was the case. But on the other hand, it couldn't have been anything else. It would have failed if it was.
Mm-hmm. And then I think the real question that the unself-forgiving people are asking is like, and I think it's a good question, and I think there's growth in this question. I have set a foundation of achieving success with self-knowledge and doing what I know I can do and working inside those parameters. How do I use that foundation as a place to build something else, right? So I was able to set that foundation in fitness onto which, and this is really like my model for everything else I'm trying to do in life, because I just feel, you know, aside from being pretty injured for the last 6 months, pretty unstoppable in that respect compared to in that arena compared to other arenas in my life. Like I love going to the gym. I love doing these physical things. I love these challenges. I'm so happy to be, I'm not going to curse myself and say that, because the last time I told you I was almost healed, it was like a week of hell right after that. But I'm enthusiastic about being 100% recovered at some point in the future. All of these things, like that has been one of the greatest areas of success, considering the fact that I was a fat kid, that I was, you know, skinny and weak in high school, that I had nicknames as late as like junior varsity baseball that were based on my lack of athletic ability. You know, to be here at 42 is very, very satisfying to me. So I have established a foundation of knowing myself, paying attention to myself. I think a kind of self-integration around like, what are my goals? What are my fears? What are my emotions? What is my knowledge base on all this thing to create something that works to like build to the next thing, which now is hampered by being injured. But I mean, I know if I can get back to 100% that I can continue to ascend at least for a while, you know, until wearing down on the body of time becomes inevitable. But I know I have years left. So using that foundation of self-integration to achieve some level of success, how do we go to the next level? That's the question that the unself-forgiving people want answered.
Let's continue to talk about the fitness parable here.
Sure.
Sometimes there's no less next level. I'm 44 years old. I squat pretty heavy. At some point, my struggle will be to take weight off of the barbell as slowly as I can. Like, I'm not going to get PRs into my 85th year.
Right.
So what do I do? I mean, all I can do is do the best I can do. That's all I can do.
Jeez, you're right. You're right. Because like self-discipline is at some point saying, I shouldn't go into the racquetball court today.
Yeah, I've got tendonitis. And if I go in there, it's going to flare up again. And then I won't be able to play for 3 weeks. So I have to forbear today or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a point where it's this goddamn American striving management fetish thing that everything has to be managed, everything has to be approved, TQM, everything, total quality management of everything from your physical being to your career to your personal finances, your marriage, everything in your life has to be continually on a path of improvement. And it's just not very kind to try to prosecute everything in our lives like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm struggling with that because, I mean, you know, I ran that business. We had a bunch of employees and a bunch of clients, and it was – I mean, that's how you have to do it. Like, you got to get better or your business will fall apart. And I coach people, right? To goals. We train, we don't exercise, we train towards a goal. And so I'm trying to help them manage their performance to approximate some sort of a perfection, but not everything can be managed.
Right.
Not everything can be managed. I've got teenage daughters and love them very much. And I want good things for them and want them to live the good life. I can't manage them. Like, what are you going to do? Like, everybody wants to manage their kids. They want to have a, you know, full schedule and they want to point them out down the road and they want to have them do, I don't even know. Right. But they all, everybody's out there. You know, you see it all the time. People out there trying to manage their kids, but it's just going to be heartbreak. And it's hard to manage yourself too. There are certain things that we have to manage. We need to retire, right? We got to save a little money. Got to get a little bit of return. We're going to have to, you know, make sure we can have some money when we retire so we don't have to eat old Roy dog food. But but you can't manage everything. You just can't. I'm trying to sort through all that. I have in selling that business, I've been able to kind of step away from that world a little bit. And I'm trying to shake off that management mindset. And I'm not that successful at it some days. And other days I lay on my ass and get bed sores. And then I feel bad about that. And then the next day I hit it too hard. And, you know, I've got no moderation in my life. I'm an utter mess. It's fine. What are you going to do? You know, I got these cards.
Cards?
Yeah, I got these cards that were dealt.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've been walking the earth like Cain for 44 years. And I just got to play my cards as best I can. I don't get overs. It's fine, you know, but that's hard to accept sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that the people have a real desire to play a lot of the cards better, right? Like,
I play somebody else's cards.
Well, no. I mean, I think in the right situation, I could play a 2-7 offsuit successfully, great, you know? That's not about getting dealt the best cards. That's about developing skills to play with cards that you have. I'm not going to promise that I've ever won a hand with a 2-7 offsuit, but I feel in the right situation. It's really good if you don't drink, you drink. But if you don't drink, play poker with people who drink. What a great situation for winning money. But yeah, I think that that's a desire that a lot of, especially the younger listeners who are still very hungry for their definition of success, would say, okay, yeah, I'm not resigning to play the cards that you're dealt. I want to play those cards the best I possibly can. And I think it's a very healthy thing to think that you could play them better. You know,
well, I think so too. But when you misplay, it's okay.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Okay. We've just got this life to live, and that's really the thing. You know, just live it. Try to do well, but you know, be kind and avoid that social comparison. I mean, I think that that's the thing about the willing thing that I've been hammering on. I don't have a problem with Jocko, but people compare themselves to him, and they shouldn't. He's him, and he's a completely unique person, and he's a little extreme, and maybe we ain't, or maybe you are in a different way that isn't valuable to anybody but you.
I imagine he's built some kind of brand around like trying to instruct people on how to become more like him, though.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, maybe I've done that too a little bit, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm somebody that can tolerate weight training, and I somehow have attracted more people that can. I haven't created anybody.
Yeah.
That I haven't instilled in anyone a desire to squat double body weight.
Right.
You can't do that. You can't do that. People either want to do that or come to want to do that by and by, but I can't instill that in them. But we've put up a little, you know, put up some signposts to help people find out where we are so we can help them do that thing they already want to do, you know, and maybe save them some calories and save them some heartbreak by letting them benefit from our experience.
Yeah.
But, you know, they've already got it in them. I've already got it in them by the time I see them.
So in what you do, one of the things that you've communicated well is like the work in progress kind of thing. And that's really important because it makes, as you're trying to lead people in certain ways, like you're a leader at Online Great Books, you're a leader, you and Matt at Barbell Logic, not taking the Jocko Willink approach, like, because I think there's a lot of people who want to do better, but just maybe aren't effectively inspired by that. You know, or they are. This is what I think happens. People will burn super bright very quickly and then burn out because they are what you're saying. They're like a one in a million kind of person. And it's like, you can be one in a million too. Yeah, but not this way. Not this one in a million. And, you know, people try to pursue that person's path based on whatever inspiration they create on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and they burn out and they retreat. And I think like being able to develop a slow and steady burn is much more effective than being like a match strike, which is what I see a lot of, you know, whether it's like political libertarian personalities or these self-improvement types of people, they build huge followings and then they just kind of vanish. You know, it's something we've seen more than once. And my approach, because it's really the only honest approach that I can take to what I do, is I was a teacher and I got a lot of meaning out of that. And I want to teach people things that I think are valuable. And I've picked things through the course of doing this show that are things that in certain areas I'm succeeding in. And in other areas, there's much room for improvement. But we're ready to go to press right now with what it is. And, you know, I can bring in people who are more expert on that thing and or people who've had more success with that thing. And I think like in all the things that I've really been happy with that we've done here, I was always in the middle. You know, I was always still a work in progress when we hit record. And I feel like that is very much the case with the self-discipline topic too. You know, there's areas where, you know, I've really got it down. And then there's areas that are kind of embarrassing, but I'm ready to have conversations about it, and I hope people will benefit from that. So I think that you saying, I'm still having lots of questions myself, I think that's great, because you also have lots of answers. So I appreciate it.
I think that you are still a teacher.
Yeah.
And I think that your show and you are at your best when you show yourself learning in all those series that you named were exactly that. And that's just one of the things that people love about Brett in School Sucks, I think. But I think that's my grandmother would say the mainest thing.
Yeah. Thank you. I definitely appreciate that. We have one more thing we got to talk about before we wrap up.
Mm.
Next month, you are one of the presenters at the very first University virtual summit. It's called Ideas into Action. I wanted to just let you know that our conversation was extremely enjoyable for me. I think I said to you, it was like the perfect balance of value and like a fun and entertaining conversation, which is one of the things that I hope we do best at School Sucks. So I really value your contribution, and I hope lots of people will be able to hear it.
Who doesn't love infotainment?
I know. I know. As long as it has enough info.
If they don't like infotainment, we don't want them.
Oh, that's exactly it.
The talk you and I had was about how to read a book, about Mortimer Adler's book, How to Read a Book, and how you might tackle reading that book you're a little bit scared of.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about the squat and how I program and work my way up to a heavy squat, and then I practice the heavies before I actually break at the knees and the hips and head for the ground. Well, Mortimer gives us a step-by-step plan on how we can tackle those books that we're scared of. We don't think we're smart enough for, we think that are over our heads. There is no how to read a book.
Mm-hmm.
Like at some point, it's not Turtles All the Way Down. Like at some point, you have to grab that book. But we talk about that one, and I encourage everyone to go read that book. In fact, we could get rid of most English departments in most schools if they would just, in the eighth grade, just read that and then just shut everything down.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody would be way better off.
Oh, absolutely. I think we extended it in our conversation to, you know, how to read anything else most effectively as well. I want to thank you for that contribution. And in the very near future, I'm going to create a way, like in the very, very near future, like next week, for you to offer it to your audience. Right now, I'm just doing this exclusive special offer for School Sucks listeners, because this is the first time that we've done it. I'm trying to fill the seats with as many familiar and friendly faces as possible. But in the very near future, we will open it up to the online Great Books audience to step in, and hopefully we'll see some of your people in there as well. But I'm very, very excited about this. I think this is certainly the next phase of what we're trying to do here, which is condensing a whole lot, like, you know, hundreds of hours of the lessons from podcast materials, or the lessons from hundreds of hours of podcasts, into a nice and neat 3-day delivery. So thank you again for your contribution.
No, my shameless plug. You're yes. Welcome. Thank you for having me. It's so much fun. If I had nothing to sell, I would still like to do it.
Yeah.
But Online Great Books enrollment opens September 8th. We'll be open for 7 days, and you can go there and get a discount if you use the promo code SCHOOLSUCKS and help Brett's show. Yeah, go sign up there, and we will shepherd you through how to read a book and some of these books that you wish you had read a long time ago. You know, that asshole at the party that's all well-read and you wish you were well-read? We'll help you be that guy.
That asshole.
That's right.
You could be Matt Damon at that Harvard bar.
Right.
Yeah, that would be ideal. All right, Scott. Well, thank you for all your contributions to this series as well, and I look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Oh, always a pleasure. So much fun. Thanks, Uncle Brett.